Buddhist Geeks. Seriously Buddhist, seriously geeky. Episode 110, Embodied Zen. This week, Gary Shishinwick Roshi joins us to continue discussing the various ways that Zen can be embodied in our experience. This is part two of a two-part series. Buddhist Geeks is supported largely by the generosity of our listeners. If you like what we're doing, please consider making a one-time or a small recurring donation by visiting buddhadharma20.com/donate.
I started to say earlier that when a student passes their first koan, from my perspective, that's when practice begins. Okay? And it's not just having insight that it's important. How do you integrate that insight into your life? And there definitely are students who are good at doing koans and go through all of the koans, but then they haven't learned how to integrate it into their life. You know, and that's where the teacher has to use other upayas. And unless a student has learned how to integrate it into their life, it would be hard to give Dharma transmission to them or call them a teacher or a Zen master. And it's much more difficult to learn how to integrate it into your life because we have all kinds of karmic traces that we have to deal with. We have all kinds of unconscious behavior patterns. We have all kinds of hidden beliefs that control the way that we relate to people and the way we relate to the environment, the way we relate to the world, the way we relate to institutions that we're not aware of. You know, so this practice has to be about bringing all of that into the conscious mind, and then there have to be effective ways of dealing with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I get the impression when someone goes in to actually interview with you or another teacher that this isn't like a discussion you'd have with like a professor. Let's talk about, like you're saying, the difference between live and dead words.
Right.
So I wonder if you could give us a glimpse into the world of interviewing with a Zen teacher and what that's like if you're working on a koan or just in any other way.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's hard to do that without a particular issue, you know, or something that we're dealing with specifically. It's hard to talk about it in general. But, you know, we say that when a student comes in, to leave all pretenses at the door, you know, that to just totally uncloak themselves and be open and honest and straightforward. And I heard Dido Lori say that it's like playing ping pong in a way. The student has to serve the ball and then the teacher can hit it back, you know. But, you know, sometimes teachers will take the first move, particularly if a student is reticent, you know, to help open them up. You know, and for beginning students, you know, a lot of it is instruction, you know, of how to do things. Now, in that book that we keep mentioning, The Three Pillars of Zen, one of Yasutani Roshi's instructions is not to bring personal issues into the interview room, but only to bring things relating to practice.
Mm-hmm.
When I first started teaching, that's all that students brought in were their personal issues. So that's why we developed a Great Heart Way, in order to deal with these things. Now, sometimes interviews will just last for a few seconds, you know, but sometimes, you know, we'll have to just keep pushing the student, poking and prodding, you know, to get them to go deeper. But there has to be a certain level of trust. I mean, the student has to be willing to allow the teacher to prod and poke. And if the student isn't willing to do that, there's only so much that you can do. And I require that, you know, students give me that permission. And if they don't, then we'll just have a nice time.
Gotcha. And I found it really interesting what you're saying about the difference between bringing up personal issues versus bringing up things directly related to the practice. And I was wondering if you could say a little more about that and why. What was the significance of Yasutani Roshi mentioning that? Because I've heard that distinction also from other teachers.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with most of the people who trained traditionally were monks in monastic settings. And they didn't have a lot of the issues of livelihood. They didn't have issues of relationships. And I think that it was felt it was a waste of time, you know, to do that. And I also heard that if a student had too many emotional issues that they would just unceremoniously ask them to leave. So they wanted people who had a strong sense of themselves so that they could just go into the practice without a lot of digression or diversion. But as I mentioned, that's not the nature of the practice in this country. So we have to develop techniques or upayas to deal with.
The live words versus dead words is really significant to me. And it seems like I've always felt my perception of koan practice lends itself to pushing a practitioner into live words. It gives less of an option to go to the conceptual hijacking of our experience. Or if you do, it would be more obvious. It seems like that to me. I wonder if that's the case, if it just seems like you're getting to more of a real discussion quicker in that kind of practice.
Well, it cuts through a lot of BS, that's for sure. Yeah. And one of the things that I tell my students is that this is a practice about continually stepping into the unknown. And when we become too familiar with things, then they start becoming by rote or conceptual. And part of the reasons that we want to stay in our comfort zone is that we feel we have a sense of control over our environment, although that's really a false notion. So to be comfortable continually stepping into the unknown, and when you do that, then whatever expression comes forward is spontaneous. You know, it's not something that you've cogitated and ruminated and about and planned and prepared. And you might be wondering if there's a standard pat answer to koans as well. And the way I deal with it, it doesn't have just to do with that. It has to do with the whole presentation. You know, like what we talked earlier about Soen Roshi and the last words of Christ. It's how you present it as well as what you present.
You get marks for presentation as well.
just kidding. Yeah. Well, you know, in a way, it's true. My Zuma Roshi told me that he used to tell me several times, he says, you know, we're not actors here, you know, but I want you to really put yourself into it. And sometimes, you know, you have to put yourself into different kinds of situations and different roles, so to speak.
Yeah. Interesting. I had one last question about koan training, and that has to do with, I've heard certain teachers contemporizing. I'm wondering how that works and if you do that kind of thing, or what example of that might be too.
Well, I mean, an example I often use, there's a Japanese teacher in Los Angeles named Joshu Suzaki, and he's actually 101 years old now. He's been in this country for a long time. And he would ask his students, how do you realize your true nature while driving a car on the Los Angeles freeway? That was a koan that he would assign to them. But I also tell my students that the best koans are the ones that come directly out of their lives. You know, so if the practice doesn't really help them deal with some of these situations that they get into in their life about how to work through it, you know, then it's kind of a dead practice. So in a sense, those are contemporary koans because people might, you know, bring in a situation they have at work or in their family, or balancing their kids and their practice time or other things like that. And so that becomes a koan. We use that as practice.
And since we've already touched on this several times, I want to hear more about this great heart way and how you work with students who do just naturally have a different way of approaching things. They're not monks. Yeah. They have their unique Western psychological issues. They bring those to the table sometimes, whether they want to or not, I'm sure. And I'm wondering, yeah, what the Great Heart Way is and how does that fit in also with the traditional forms?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, the Great Heart Way was developed by me and my teaching partner, Ilya Shinko Perez. And we've developed it over a number of years. And like I mentioned earlier, when I first started teaching, that was a lot, emotional issues, psychological issues were brought into the private interview room by a lot of students. And one of the things that I learned pretty early on is that most students live in their heads. They don't live in their bodies. And a phrase that I don't know if he coined it, but Reggie Ray talks about floating heads, you know, that a lot of practitioners, meditation practitioners in the Tibetan tradition, are floating heads, you know, and also in Zen, a a lot of them are floating because they're not connected. So if a student comes into me and says that they're really angry, I say, well, ask them, what does it feel like? The first thing they might say is, my girlfriend left me. And I'll say, well, that's a storyline. What does it feel like? And they'll say, and she took our dog and my truck and my cigarettes. You know, and I'll keep saying, what does it feel like? What does it feel like? I mean, that story, that's your storyline. And eventually they'll begin, you know, to feel the tightness, you know, in their throat or in their heart or something like that. And that's where we want them to pay their attention, not on all of the rationalizations and judgments and projections that they have about it. You know, just get into the body. This, and Zazen, you know, Zen meditation is body-centered meditation. Most people don't get that, or it takes them a long time to get it. So the important mantra that we teach in the Great Heart Way is non-judgmental awareness. Don't judge it. No matter, you don't have to justify how you feel. How you feel does not make you a worthy or an unworthy person. It doesn't make you good or bad. It doesn't make you right or wrong. It's just what you're feeling. Okay? But most people are not in touch with the feelings. And so that's the first step, is learn how to feel. What does anger feel like? You know, what does sadness feel like? What does joy feel like? Where is it in your body? Is it localized? Is it spread over your whole body? Just sit with it. That's the focus of their meditation, is what's going on inside of the body. And then once they start getting in touch with this, they begin to see that there isn't any element of good or bad in the feeling of anger. The good or bad is how you act it out. But the feeling itself is just energy that's either blocked in your body or energy that's flowing rampantly, or, you know, or it could be, you know, a balanced flow of energy as well. So once they get in touch with that, and if there are situations in their life where once they are in touch with that feeling, where they see that feeling constantly recurring, then we begin to work with that feeling. And they just sit with that feeling and try to just reflect on moment times when it occurred in their life. We don't ask them to do a scan of their life, you know, but that's the realm of psychoanalysis. But this, as we explain in our book, The Great Heart Way, what often happens is an image pops up very strong in people's minds. And they, from that image, they begin to see how they formed this belief system that develop this habit pattern that they keep doing certain things when it's triggered in their life. And I can give an example from my own experience in doing it, which I talk about in the book itself. By most standards, I'm a fairly successful person. I did very well in school. I got straight A's in high school. I was a Phi Beta Kappa in college. I got a PhD in physics from University of California in Berkeley, which at that time was considered the best physics school in the country, and I was an athlete. I lettered in a number of sports. I was a state swimming champion in high school, and then I went on and had a number of careers, but there was always this thought in my mind that I'm not good enough, and even after I became a Dharma successor of Maizumi Roshi, I still had that thought, I'm not good enough, and obviously, that was driving me to be as successful as I was, because I had to prove that I was good enough. And when I was sitting with the feeling, I had several images come up, but the one that I finally settled on was when I was about 6 or 7 years old. I was in religious school, and they were talking about the stories in the Bible. And one of the stories was about Abraham and Isaac, where Abraham was ordered by God to sacrifice his son Isaac to show his devotion and his dedication, you know, to God and to the religion. And he took his son and was going to sacrifice him. And I reread the Bible recently. He deceived his wife. He deceived his retainers, and he took his son and was ready, bound him up, and was ready to kill him. You know, when the God intervened and there was a ram that was caught nearby in the bush that he should sacrifice instead because he had shown his true faith. Well, when I heard that at that age, I immediately said to myself, they're going to kill Isaac, and he was a good, loyal son. What are they going to do with somebody like me? You know, so I said, you know, I had better, really be imperfect behavior to do, always do well. Otherwise, I'm going to die. And I had that belief. It was at an unconscious, almost cellular level. And through this practice and through meditation, I was able to uncover it. And then there's certain techniques we give on how to heal it and to dissolve it in the book.
Interesting. And how do you find when people are able to do that kind of work? Does it change then their ability to do the other kinds of work? Or does it just have a healthy impact on their psyche and then their ability to be, you know, just good people in general?
Well, I think it's both. Uh-huh. Yeah. I find that the people aren't as controlled by their unconscious mind. And we give a quote from Jung in the book where he says that meditation seems to be the royal road to the unconscious. And that's what it is. It's unconscious behavior patterns and beliefs, and usually they're established when we're quite young and we continue them forward. Now, does that help people to go deeper into their regular practice? My experience is yes, it does.
I do want to ask one last question that we've touched on a little bit. You said it was a whole nother story, but I am wondering how you've integrated in your own experience, your own understanding, this difference that is often seen between the Soto school and the Rinzai school. And it's really, it's not just the schools. It's also, I think, something that you see in all the different Buddhist traditions and maybe even goes beyond the Buddhist traditions in general. But I mean, in short, it's this difference between trying to get somewhere, you know, get to awakening. This in the Rinzai tradition, my understanding is oftentimes there's the real emphasis on having Kensho or Satori. And then this other perspective, which is like, it's already here. You know, we really just have to kind of wake up to it or realize it. You know, there's not really anywhere to go in a certain way. And I'm wondering, yeah, how you've found a way to integrate those things or bring them together, because it seems like clearly you're doing that in your practice. I'm just wondering how you've done that, you know, in other ways.
Well, even one of the founders of Soto Zen in Japan, Keizan, wrote not to think that enlightenment doesn't exist, because there is kind of a sickness in the Soto school to say that, you know, everything is enlightened, you know, and so you just have to sit like the Buddha, and you're manifesting your enlightenment. So that's a false understanding. And there's even an expression for it called Buji Zen, which is do nothing Zen. You know, it's kind of like, I'm already enlightened, so whatever I do is an expression of my enlightened life. And that's just a gross misunderstanding. But the other part of that is a weakness of Rinzai Zen is thinking that enlightenment is something that you can obtain that's external to yourself, and if you just work hard enough, you're going to find it, and then you have all kinds of ideas about what it is. You know? Whereas so the Soto realization, you know, that we are already enlightened, you know, integrated with the actual experience of it, I think is a much more wholesome approach. And Yasutani Roshi and Maizumi Roshi both talked about two aspects of it. One is intrinsic. Intrinsically, we all are the Buddha. However, if you don't experience it, then it's not true for you. And that's the experiential. So the intrinsic and the experiential have to come together. Otherwise, it's just speculation. You know, and it's not something that has been embodied. And that's very important.